Okay, well, if you want to open your Bibles, we'll be in 3 John tonight. 3 John tonight. Yeah. We did 2 John last week, John. So I'm going to... I'm going to skip a lot of the introductory material about John that we went through last week, we'll just jump right into it. I think all that's still fresh in our mind, and it certainly applies, obviously, to this short little letter of 14 verses as well. So let's take a look at just the first four verses of John's third little letter here. The elder, to my dear friend Gaius, whom I love in the truth. Dear friend, I pray that you may enjoy good health and that all may go well with you, even as your soul is getting along well. It gave me great joy to have some brothers come and tell me about your faithfulness to the truth and how you continue to walk in the truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth. In many ways, 3 John is a letter of contrasts to that of 2 John. I think we mentioned this last week. And one of the first contrasts that we notice is that this letter is one of only two New Testament letters that are personally addressed to an individual, Philemon being the other New Testament letter. And whereas 2 John was addressed to an unidentified church, 3 John is addressed to a clearly defined individual, a man by the name of Gaius. Now, we don't know much about Gaius, other than the fact that he was likely a member of a church in Asia where there was an internal problem there with a dominating leader. And we're going to see two other characters in this letter, Diotrephes and Demetrius. We'll come to them in a moment. But we don't know a whole lot about Gaius, other than this letter's addressed to him, and that John addresses it literally to Gaius the Beloved. That's how it's addressed. I mean, what a term of endearment and love from John. It's literally the elder to the beloved. The elder to the beloved. These were terms of endearment between these two men. I believe we can see straight away in these first couple of verses that John had a truth-based relationship with Gaius. He says, whom I love in the truth. He didn't have a sappy sentimental relationship with Gaius. He had a truth-based relationship with him. As we saw last week, there is a big difference between unwise relationships that have degenerated to the level of selfish sentimentality rather than truth. Huge difference. And Gaius was not a yes man. He was not a yes man to John. He was not a wallflower pushover either. He and John were in a truth-based relationship. And so both were comfortable in their own skin, they were comfortable in their own gifts, and thus they were comfortable with each other. John the Apostle John, the beloved to Gaius, or the elder to the beloved Gaius. You know, you just get the feeling these guys were like that. They were like that, and they were like that in truth, in commitment, and what they were after. What drove them? Who indwelt them is what gave them that. We see here, too, that Gaius appears to have had some reputation of spiritual maturity, as seen by his soul getting along well. You know, there's some indication of that. His soul was getting along well. He wasn't floundering somewhere spiritually. John's prayer that Gaius might enjoy good health, along with that prospering soul, literally that he might prosper concerning all things, You know, this reminds us that we need to be concerned about the health and well-being of our beloveds, even in the temporal needs of this life. You know, this includes body as well as soul and spirit. John was concerned about Gaius' body. I hope you're well, really. I hope you're getting along as well in your body as you are in your soul. Yeah, I hope that for everybody in this room. And I hope we all take care of our bodies long so we can take care of our bodies as well as we take care of our souls and keep them both progressing well. But, you know, John clearly indicates that there's a place for being concerned about people's physical needs as well. And like 2 John, we note here that the word truth is used four times in just these first four opening verses. And John says that it gave him great joy to hear of Gaius's faithfulness. John says he had no greater joy in life than to hear that his children were walking in the truth. Here's another contrast. John speaks of this joy in your children in 2 John 4. Do you remember that? I have great joy in hearing about your children. But here, his joy is in his children. Just another contrast. This might suggest that Gaius was a direct convert of John's, or else a member of a church that John was responsible for. You know, there was some sense of connection there, that John could refer to him as his own child. No greater joy in life than to hear that his children were walking in truth. Is what John said. Do you know this kind of joy? You ever had that? I had a taste of this earlier this year when an unsaved friend of mine came to visit who I haven't seen in 30 years but had prayed for that entire time. And while she was here, I was able to share the gospel with her and lead her to Christ. And I cannot explain to you the joy I had in my heart for the next couple of weeks as a result of that. It was, I just can't explain it. I felt like I could have died and gone to heaven right then. It was that, honestly, it's like, hey, it's all good. You know, it's all, let's go. I'm ready to go now. I don't know how, if you've ever experienced that joy of knowing that your children are walking in the truth or leading someone to the truth out of darkness. Fewer, if any, things, I believe, compared to the joy of spiritual children who are walking in the truth. And equally, fewer things are more grievous than to know that your children, biological or spiritual, are not walking in the truth. That's as heavy the other side as the joy is on the other. May the Lord give us more of this joy as we lead others to Him and develop truth-based relationships with folks while we're on this pilgrimage home. There's great joy to be found there. Look at the next couple of verses 5 through 8. Dear friend, you are faithful in what you are doing for the brothers, even though they're strangers to you. They have told the church about your love. You will do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God. It was for the sake of the name that they went out, receiving no help from the pagans. We ought, therefore, to show hospitality to such men, so that we may work together for the truth. What had happened was that some traveling teachers and preachers, sent most likely from John in the church in Jerusalem, had been welcomed and shown hospitality by Gaius when they came to his church, even though they were strangers to him. And they returned and reported to John of this loving faithfulness of Gaius and this hospitality that they had received from him. You see, in those days, these itinerant teachers and preachers were very important to the building up of the body of Christ and to equipping the church. But when they traveled, they couldn't simply check into the local Holiday Inn somewhere for their food and lodging. They needed hospitality, and they needed support of Christians in the places where they traveled to. And Gaius was just one of those people. He offered them the hospitality that they needed when they came. And Gaius was working together with these men. He shared their vision. He shared what they were on about. They were working together for the truth, John says. So Gaius offers these men sacrificial hospitality, I might add, when these guys came, at personal risk to his own potential being disfellowshipped, as we'll see as we go through this letter. You know, we can never fully estimate what true co-laboring hospitality can result in, really. There's a story told of a Christian businessman in Chicago who rang his wife late one afternoon at work, asking if it was okay to bring home a foreigner as a guest for dinner that night. And at the time, this wife had, she had 3 children in school and a preschooler, so she had a lot on her plate to do besides entertaining strangers. But she consented and went along with the meal, and it went off without a hitch. And this foreigner, an important Spanish government official, he never forgot that meal in that house. And some years later, some friends of this couple were sent to Spain as missionaries. And their entire work got put on hold because of some governmental regulations and red tape, and something was holding it up. But when this Spanish official caught word that these missionaries were friends of the couple that had given him this meal, he was able to clear the way of these restrictions. And as a result of that, there's a church now in that province in Spain today. One meal of hospitality, there's a church planted across the oceans. Does this sort of sound like, it's almost like then they entertained strangers unaware, meaning of angels, though I don't think he was an angel, but we just can't appreciate what one simple act of obedience, what one simple act in this letter is telling us of hospitality and of sharing in the work for the truth. That's the point. Sharing in the work for the truth. I think we see another contrast here with that of 2 John. In that letter, John emphasized not giving hospitality to false teachers. Do you remember? To such, don't even say greetings, right? But here, he urges to give hospitality to true teachers. Another contrast. In fact, he says to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God. This implies a wholehearted support and ascending as they recognized God at work in what these teachers were doing. This wasn't just there's a room for you, here's some food. No, this was, they were heart and soul with these men in sharing it, opening up their place. You know, Warren Wiersbe observes that it's one thing to fight apostasy and refuse to entertain false teachers. It's quite another to open up our homes and wallets to promote the truth. Unquote. Have a look at verse 7. I'm not sure what translations you've got, but it's interesting to note that in the Greek, verse 7 begins with the word for. Is that what you have?
Of course.
Because, for, we've got another linking word here, conjunction, linking it to the previous verse, and it links the reason here why these men should be sent on their way in a manner worthy of God. Do you see it? For, John reminds Gaius, that it was for the sake of the name, that is, for the sake of Jesus in the gospel, that these men went out. That's why. The name and the way became titles for followers of Jesus and was the name of their belief before the term Christian was actually used. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Remember in Acts chapter 9, verse 2, Saul, while he was still breathing out murderous threats against the Lord's disciples, he went to the high priest and asked for for letters to the synagogues in Damascus so that he could go, and any that he found there who belonged to the way, whether men or women, he might take them as prisoners to Jerusalem. Acts 19:19. But some of them became obstinate. They refused to believe, and they publicly maligned the way. About that time, there arose a great disturbance about the way. Paul, in Acts 22, said, I persecuted the followers of this way. And Acts 24, again, however, I admit that I worship the God of our fathers as a follower of the way, which they call a sect. So Paul's saying at that time, Christianity was just seen as a Jewish sect. Then Felix, who was well acquainted with the way, adjourned the proceedings. It's amazing the number of times that it's in there. It wasn't just a one-off occurrence. It's because of the way and for the sake of the name that these men went out. It's for that reason that they are to be shown hospitality, to be sent on in a manner worthy of God. And when John said that to Gaius, he wasn't just issuing an order to John. In verse 7, when he says, to send these men on, he gave him a reason why. The linking of verse 6 and verse 7 is done in the same way John linked verse 6 and 7 together back in 2 John with the word because. Do you remember that? It's funny. It's the same two verse numbers with the same conjunction, the same thought. Because. It was because, in 2 John, it was because of the many deceivers had gone out into the world that they were to hold on to the original form of apostolic teaching that they'd received. He gave them a reason why. We need to beware of authoritarian, dominating, because I said so, leaders. John's not like that. He gave a reason for why he was saying what he was saying, or for the request that he was asking. True leaders are to be persuaders, not dominators. True leaders are to be persuaders who rely on truth-based dialogue as the arena and channel of service. Truth-based dialogue. I can't remember where I found this quote, but it's been written in the margin of my Bible for nearly 30 years now. And it says this: if the desire for truth is not the basis for leadership in the body, then the trust which can be generated by their service is just another form of subtle power, the power we call manipulation. Let me read that again. If the desire for truth is not the basis for leadership in the body, then the trust which can be generated by their service is just another more subtle form of power, the power we call manipulation. You ever seen any manipulators? Any dominators, manipulators? No reason for this, just do it. I said so. John wasn't like that. John was neither a manipulator nor an authoritarian. But he was a truth teller. And he didn't shirk from calling a spade a spade. And he wasn't weak, and neither was Gaius. Strong men, but not authoritarian, not dominating. John reminds Gaius that these true teachers went out receiving no help from the pagans. Receiving no help from the pagans. He says, we ought therefore to show hospitality to such men so that we may work together for the truth. Zane Hodges comments that naturally it was inappropriate for those who went out to teach to seek support from those who did not believe in or honor that name. But the fact that the Christian preachers sought no help from the unsaved meant that Christians were under a special obligation to assist them. This obligation continues to this day, as Wiersbe helps us see when he says, the ministry of hospitality and support is not only an opportunity, it's also an obligation. Galatians 6:6 makes it clear that those who receive spiritual blessing from the minister of the word ought to share with him in material blessings. biblical. That's what John's saying. Wiersbe says, you pay your board where you get your food. That's how he puts it. John says, to support those who bring you spiritual food, or to support those who bring you spiritual food, is to work together for the truth. That's what you're doing. This is more than simply tithing. It means a personal, prayerful, providing participation in a shared vision and direction called the truth. It's heart-based. There's something visceral about this. It's not just going through the motions, in other words. Look at verses 9 to 11. He says, I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first, will have nothing to do with us. So if I come, I will call attention to what he is doing, gossiping maliciously about us. And not satisfied with that, he refuses to welcome the brothers. He also stops those who want to do so and puts them out of the church. Dear friend, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. Anyone who does what is good is from God. Anyone who does what is evil has not seen God. John made this entire appeal to Gaius because of the dominating behavior of Diotrephes, an overbearing, self-willed authoritarian who was guilty of three things we see in this passage. First, he was guilty of preeminence. Diotrephes loved to have the preeminence among them. He had to be first. He had to be top dog. He had to be preeminent among them all. And he refused to have anything to do with us, that is the Apostle John and presumably other gifted apostolic men. And he demonstrated this by gossiping maliciously, John says. Literally, he was, that's what it says in the Greek, prattling nonsense with evil words against us. Just prattling nonsense with evil words against us and against John's apostolic authority. It would seem that this Diotrephes was a selfishly ambitious, I call him a little man, who felt threatened by true apostolic power and authority. You ever seen it? You ever seen that? So what did he do? He did his best to tear down the reputation of John. He reminds us, I think, of the wife who said, my husband and I have managed to be happy together for 20 years. I guess that's because we both are in love with the same man. Diotrephes was in love with himself. He was the exact opposite of the steady, strong, humble Gaius. Gaius, who was not a yes man, he was not a doormat, he was comfortable in his own skin, knew his gifts, and so he was comfortable with the Apostle Paul. Gaius was not a little man, Diotrephes was. Gaius didn't need to have the preeminence, but he worked together for the truth and showed hospitality to these guys. It's worth noting here another contrast. This verse reminds us that we are to test the accusations that are brought against leaders within the church. Remember, Paul tells us in 1 Timothy 5:19, do not entertain an accusation against an elder unless it's brought by the testimony of two or three witnesses. Whereas back in 1 John 4, here's the contrast, we're told to test those who come to us from without. It says, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they're from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. Don't entertain an accusation, a one-off accusation from a Diotrephes about an elder in the church, or anyone else for that matter, unless it's brought by the testimony of two or three. Second thing we see that Diotrephes is guilty of here is that he's guilty of not showing hospitality. Not being satisfied with that, Diotrephes refused to welcome or show hospitality to the brothers who came to them as true teachers and true preachers of the word. Unlike Gaius, Diotrephes was not walking in faithfulness to the truth. If he's not welcoming these guys, if he's not of one heart and soul with them, he's not working with the truth. He's working against it. He was not contending together for the faith, as Jude speaks of. And the third thing we see that Diotrephes is guilty of here is that he was doing everything he could to impose his will on others, even to the point of disfellowshipping anyone who offered hospitality to the men John was sending. He was using the threat and act of church discipline to force the members of the church to become inhospitable and to not support these men. In doing so, Diotrephes became an enemy of the gospel, for he was no longer working together for the truth. Reminds me of some of the early days, early days for us, some of the schisms that happened within the brethren, the exclusive brethren, between Darby and some of those men. You know, same, it can happen, even to gifted men. You know, the breakdown relationally, where they were disfellowshipping people left and right over things that there was no point, nothing to it. Simple guilt by association, in most cases. They lost the ability to work together for the truth. You know, the New Testament does teach church discipline, and these instructions ought to be obeyed. But church discipline is not a weapon for a dictator to use to promote himself, which is what Diotrephes was doing. It's a tool for the congregation to use to promote purity and to glorify God. It's a tool in the hand of the congregation. It's the Lord himself exercising spiritual authority through the local church in order to rescue and to restore erring children of God. It's always restorative. That's the goal. Even if it means cutting off for a while, it's never the end. It's always restorative. John reminds Gaius, tells him that when he comes, or if he comes, he hopes he can come, that when he comes, he will deal with Diotrephes in a very public way. He says, by calling attention to what he is doing. John doesn't sound like a pushover. He's going to call this guy out. When he comes there, he's going to call this guy out in public. And presumably, he's going to implement the Pauline instruction in 1 Timothy 5:20. We just saw 1 Timothy 5:19, don't entertain an accusation against an elder unless it's brought by the testimony of two or three witnesses. But those, here's verse 20, those leaders who sin are to be rebuked publicly. They're to be publicly rebuked so that others may take warning. You know, this is different than your brother. If your brother sins against you, go to him quietly, him and you and him alone. And if he doesn't hear, you take two or three. And then, you know, it's escalating. No, this is just bang. This is what this man is doing. This is wrong. It stops now. You know, that's the idea. And John says to Gaius, look, in the meantime, I encourage you not to imitate this evil Diotrephes. Imitate what's good, not what's evil. And then look at verse 12. We meet the third character in this short little letter, Demetrius. Verse 12. Demetrius is well spoken of by everyone and even by the truth itself. We also speak well of him, and you know that our testimony is true. Demetrius. This Demetrius is not to be confused with the Demetrius in Acts chapter 19, verse 24, who is an enemy of the gospel. Okay, we have to be careful with that. There's lots of names in the Bible that are similar, but they're not the same people. So don't confuse him. Demetrius appears to be another apostolically approved traveling teacher that John is sending to the church where Gaius and Diotrephes are. And he's also likely the one who carried this very letter with him to Gaius. That's all we know about Demetrius. Yeah, just Demetrius. He's coming. He's a good bloke.
Not a bad CV.
He's a good guy. And as you mentioned last week, Phil, you know, the in the earlier days within, you know, the Brethren movement, there, you went from one assembly to another, you took a letter with you, vouching for you, so people knew who you were. And in some ways, that's exactly what's happened here with Demetrius. And then the last two verses, verse 13 and 14, and we'll finish up with this. It says, I have much to write to you, but I do not want to do so with pen and ink. I hope to see you soon, and we'll talk face to face. Peace to you. The friends here send their greetings. Greet the friends there by name. We saw last time, and we won't go over that again, the importance of face to face, and this seems to be a very common finishing off line for John. I don't want to use pen and ink anymore. I hope to talk to you face to face. But he uses the term friends twice in these closing statements, or the fact that he does is perhaps one final reminder to Gaius that Christians in every place are or should be a network of friends who are ready to help one another whenever a need arises. It's part of the genius of Christianity that one can meet people who you've never seen before in places far from home and discover through a shared faith an immediate bond of friendship. And I think we've all experienced something of that in the past. So that's 3 John, and we might take some time and just reflect on what we've seen there. Any observations or questions as we finish that off.